We'll turn to State of Harmon versus Salt Lake City, and we'll hear from Mr. Lutz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nicholas Lutz, and I represent Patrick Harmon Jr., Tasha Smith, and the estate of Patrick Harmon Sr., the plaintiff's appellants in this matter. Your Honor, this case arises out of the shooting death of Mr. Harmon Sr. by Defendant Officer Fox of the Salt Lake City Police Department in August of 2017. And the reason we are here today is because Mr. Harmon brought claims for violation of his Fourth Amendment rights for the use of deadly force against him for an unjustified reason. The district court below erred in dismissing plaintiff's complaint by using extraneous video evidence to disregard plaintiff's well-pled allegations. Over the next several minutes, I will address how the district court failed to honor the blatant contradiction standard that applies to video evidence introduced on a motion to dismiss. In doing so, the district court made several factual determinations entirely outside of the complaint and ultimately erroneously determined that Mr. Harmon posed a serious threat to the officers at the moment that he was shot and killed. Now, as it is what I see as the dispositive issue in this matter, it is worth discussing what this blatant contradiction standard is and what it means. The introduction of video evidence at the motion to dismiss stage does not fundamentally alter the standard under 12b-6. Just like any other 12b-6 motion and analysis, all of plaintiff's well-pled allegations are taken as true, and all reasonable inferences therefrom must be drawn in plaintiff's favor. An extraneous exhibit, in this case a video, may only be considered at this stage to the extent that it blatantly contradicts the allegations in the complaint so starkly that no reasonable jury could believe those allegations. And the standard comes from, of course, Scott v. Harris, 560 U.S., 360 United States Supreme Court decision from 2007.
Counsel, let me ask you a question about the evidence, that video evidence. So the district court, in addition to considering the full videos, considered sort of frame by frame submissions by the defense, right?
That is correct.
All right. Are you contesting on appeal the district court's ability to consider that frame by frame evidence?
We are, Your Honor. We objected at the district court level. I don't know that we went in with full candor. I don't know that we addressed it very explicitly. But I think the issue of the stills raises a very interesting point when we're talking about the blatant contradiction standard. Because if you are reviewing this evidence, if a person is reviewing a piece of video evidence and finds the need to slow it down, to stop it, to reduce it to frames, to figure out what it means, that is highly suggestive that that video evidence does not raise to that standard. Even if you could see something that was inconsistent or even contradictory from the still, if it is not blatant, flagrant, brazen, it's not going to meet that standard. So I think that it's actually very important to note that the use of stills in itself in the analysis is indicative of the fact that these videos are not of the type of clarity that would allow you to supplant plaintiff's allegations with the events therein.
Well, would it be your position then that the district court and even us on appeal, that it would be inappropriate for us to watch the video and be clicking on and off of the pause and play button to sort of decipher what happened, because this all happened so fast?
I wouldn't say that it's inappropriate, and that wasn't an issue that was raised in the district court. And that was an issue that we argued with the district court about on during oral argument in the district court. But I think it very clearly indicates, as I just said, that if that's what must happen in order to decipher what we're looking at, then it's not unambiguous.
Okay, thanks.
Just to continue to emphasize this point, I think the Fifth Circuit just explained it very well in Aguirre v. San Antonio, 995 F3D 395. That's the Fifth Circuit, 2021. A court should not discount the non-moving party story unless contrary video evidence provides so much clarity that a reasonable jury could not believe his account. When video evidence is ambiguous or in fact supports a non-movement's version of events, or when there is any evidence challenging the video's accuracy or completeness, the modified rule from Scott has no application. Only when the record eliminates any feasible claim that the non-movement's account of events is true may a court disregard the normal rule that it must credit a party's account if it is supported by sufficient evidence. Of course, this comes from summary judgment, as most of these cases do, but the standard is well set. In reviewing the video evidence submitted by defendants, what the district court did was take several critical allegations raised in plaintiff's complaint and either disregard them entirely or flip them to be drawn in the defendant's favor. And among those critical allegations are these. One, that Mr. Harmon was trying to flee from the officers at the moment that he was shot and killed, which can be seen on the video. Two, Mr. Harmon was unarmed at the moment he was shot and killed, and as the district court actually agreed with plaintiffs. Three, none of the officers, including defendant Officer Fox, ever perceived Mr. Harmon to be armed. And the unescapable inference from these allegations is that Mr. Harmon did not pose a serious and immediate threat to the officers the moment he was shot and killed. Speaking to Graham factor number two, the dispositive factor in the circuit, and therefore this use of force against Mr. Harmon violated his constitutional rights. And I would be happy to take any of the panel's questions as to any of those points if they exist.
Does it really matter that he was ultimately unarmed? I mean, that's in dispute, but we'll give it to you for this. Does it really matter that he was ultimately unarmed if he made gestures that would indicate to an officer that he was armed?
It does, Your Honor, but it matters in a nuanced way. The fact that Mr. Harmon was armed lends to the other permissible inference and the inference that should have been drawn that it's thus more unlikely that he appeared to be armed to any of the officers. And so the complaint allegations state very clearly that Officer Fox, the officer employed deadly force, never saw a weapon in Mr. Harmon's hand. The fact that a weapon is not visible in Mr. Harmon's hand was conceded by defendants at the district court level during oral argument. And what this tells us is that it's all the more likely that their perception was accurate and they didn't see a weapon in Mr. Harmon's hand, and thus it is more likely that any of the gestures that he was making are more consistent with slowing down in response to the officers chasing him, perhaps bracing himself for impact as the officer approached from below, and not, as defendants contend, making hostile motions with a weapon.
Well, as I saw the video, they never ordered him to drop anything. And the only statement that was audible was the officer yelling, "I'll effing shoot you."
That's correct, Your Honor. That was the only command, if it can be called that was issued to Mr. Harmon. And that was issued virtually simultaneously as Officer Fox unleashed his volley of shots. And we can argue about how appropriate it is to apply a state of Larson v. Murr to an unarmed suspect, but whether the suspect was ordered to drop a weapon and given the opportunity to comply is a factor there that must be taken into account in evaluating the reasonableness of deadly force in this circuit, which obviously this factor weighs very heavily in favor of Mr. Harmon.
Now, is there also a question of whether Mr. Harmon threw the officer to the ground as opposed to the officer falling to the ground after he had tried to tackle him?
I would not say that there's a question, Your Honor, because there's no allegation in the complaint that Mr. Harmon threw an officer to the ground or assaulted an officer, as the district court and defendants contend. Looking at the video, we must, on this point, return, as all others, to the blatant contradiction standard. Now, we contend that what you see on that video is a clash of bodies in a relatively chaotic situation, and there are a number of permissible inferences in plaintiff's favor that the district court could have but did not draw regarding this interaction, one of which being it's quite plausible that Officer Fox actually pushed Mr. Harmon into Officer Robinson, the other being that it was Officer Robinson's own momentum into Mr. Harmon that caused him to fall backwards to the ground. But there's no allegation and no suggestion in the complaint, and therefore no real ability of the district court to draw the inference that Mr. Harmon assaulted an officer, which obviously, of course, informs Grand Factor 1, the severity of the crime, and somewhat Grand Factor 2, you know, the degree of threat posed. But my contention is that the only thing that can be drawn from that interaction is that there was a clash and Officer Robinson fell backward.
You have a little bit of a nuanced allegation that doesn't quite square with that, because you allege that Officer Robinson fell backwards while he was trying to tackle Mr. Harmon. And wouldn't that lead to the inference instead that because he fell backwards when he was moving forwards into him, that Mr. Harmon pushed him?
I believe that would be an inference drawn in defendant's favor at this stage. It is entirely possible, and I think reasonable to infer, that when a person, you know, chases down and tries to engage with a person who's moving in another direction and a clash occurs, there can be any number of movements resulting from that.
Like
that don't necessarily.
The clash of bodies, I think, is an inference that you're making from other allegations where what the inference I'm making is an inference from your allegation. So you're wanting to make an inference from an inference, and I'm talking about an inference from your own allegation. I think that's the difference.
Perhaps I was speaking too loosely as to allegations and inferences there. So I certainly appreciate the distinction, but again, I think we have to return to the pleading standard. Under Rule 8, Mr. Harmon just has to provide a short and plain statement of the things that entitle him to relief. He's not required to dispel all potential defenses, and all inferences at this stage on a motion for 12b6 must be drawn in his favor, and one of those reasonable inferences is that there was no assault. And, Your Honors, if there are no additional questions on any of those points, with the panel's permission, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lutz. We'll hear from Ms. Nichols.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Catherine Nichols on behalf of defendants appellees Salt Lake City and Officer Fox. Plaintiffs have just spent their time arguing for a myriad of inferences about what actually did or did not happen based on their allegations and from the body cam videos of the officers. But the key in a Fourth Amendment analysis is whether it would be clear to a reasonable officer in Officer Fox's position that his conduct was unlawful in the situation he confronted. Therefore, we must keep in mind that this court's ultimate inquiry is what an officer in Officer Fox's position could reasonably have believed happened. And here, as shown on the body cam videos from the three officers, Officer Fox was faced with circumstances in which, during an arrest for a second degree felony, Mr. Harmon begged the officers to let him go free. He then broke free while being handcuffed. He pushed an officer to the ground as he fled, and then he stopped fleeing and turned back toward the officers with what reasonably appeared to be and was, in fact, a knife, all from only a few feet away.
So, Ms. Nichols, when you said that he pushed an officer down, you're talking about Officer Robinson?
Correct.
And the allegation in the complaint is that he brushed past and then the very next sentence says ran past. Now, the allegation in the complaint is not that Mr. Harmon pushed him down or th- threw him down. That's your characterization, right?
So, Your Honor, the allegation in the complaint is that Mr. Harmon pushed past Officer Robinson.
Immediately followed by the combination of words, ran past.
I think, as I read the allegation, he pushed past and continued running. Yes, as Officer Robinson was falling and he continued running. But I think that this really points to the broader point about what we're supposed to do with the video evidence. So I think as an initial matter, this court's prior cases are clear that the video doesn't have to be perfect for the court to be able to ascertain objective reasonableness from it. For example, in this court's case in Thomas v. Durastanti, the court explained that, quote, we rely on the video evidence here while acknowledging that it did not capture everything. And the court repeatedly, in a number of other cases, has relied on video. Ronquillo v. Denver, Valverde v. Dodge.
Durastanti, summary judgment?
Yes, it was.
And here we're talking about, video evidence would certainly be proper summary judgment evidence for purposes of determining Rule 56. Here, though, under a 12b6, doesn't the video evidence have a far more limited relevance? And that is only if it blatantly contradicts the allegations in the complaint. So we're not loosely looking at the video as if it were independent evidence, right?
Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. I think that's an error that plaintiffs have made in their argument. On a motion to dismiss, the court is supposed to look at the well-pled allegations and the materials that have been referenced and incorporated into the complaint. And here, there's no dispute that the body cam videos from all three officers were incorporated into the complaint. They're cited numerous times. There's a dozen or so still frame photos. And so what plaintiffs ask this court to do is watch the video and then close its eyes for most of the video, and then only look at the parts that might contradict the allegations. And I don't think that's what the court is supposed to do. It's supposed to look at the well-pled allegations and the materials that are incorporated, which include all of the videos. And where there is a contradiction, where there is a blatant contradiction, the video controls. And so I don't think it's correct that
even though the video is not clear, the video controls.
No, I didn't mean to suggest that. So I think what we're supposed to do as I mentioned, a number of cases have looked at videos even when they're not clear, and that the court has taken two approaches. So in the Thomas case, for example, the court, even though the vehicle at issue was obscured during a key part, the court was able to say, well, we saw it moving over here and we saw it moving over here. And so even though the parties dispute the speed of the vehicle, we can determine what the speed of the vehicle was, which was crucial to the determination.
Was that a 12b6 motion or was that a summary judgment?
That was summary judgment.
Isn't that a huge difference?
Your Honor, I don't think there is, because at summary judgment, what we will have is we will have additional materials. We'll have testimony from the officers. We'll have a toxicology report. We'll have a number of other things. But the video will still be central to what this court is reviewing. And so I think that this is a really important point. So that's one thing that the court did in Thomas. But then in Ronquillo, and this is a 12b6 case, in Ronquillo, the parties disputed a key factual issue, which was Mr. Ronquillo's car ran into an officer's car. And
I'm very familiar with that case. And I think it's very, very different than this case.
I think that it is very factually different. But I think what is important about it is that the court there recognized that there was a factual dispute about why the car had run into the deputy's car, whether Mr. Ronquillo had done it or the officers had done it. And the court said, we don't need to resolve that factual dispute because we view it from the viewpoint of a reasonable officer. And a reasonable officer on the scene could conclude that Mr. Ronquillo had run the car into the officers and that he was trying to flee. And then in so doing, he presented a risk to the other officers. And that is the kind of circumstance that we have here. That even
so here
if
they were afraid he was going to jump on his bicycle and pedal away.
No, I think that wasn't the issue here. Here, we have a situation in which Officer Fox is behind Mr. Harmon and Officer Robinson when they get into their tangle. And, you know, I think that it's telling that plaintiff's counsel conceded that it would be a reasonable inference to think that Mr. Harmon had pushed off, had pushed Officer Robinson.
Even if he pushed him, let's, I'll give you that. Three officers, a single guy on a bicycle, they get into a scuffle. They don't tell him to drop anything. Nobody, I couldn't see anything in the video. And he says, I'm going to fucking shoot you. And he does. Now, is that just standard operating procedure in Salt Lake?
No, Your Honor. The court's inquiry here is the totality of the circumstances, as the court is well aware. So you're looking at the fact that he's being arrested for a second degree felony. He's begging the officers to let him go.
How old was that second degree felony? What was the felony?
It was for aggravated assault. I don't think the year is in the
several
record.
Years earlier.
I don't think it's in the record.
Okay.
And so the we're viewing this from the viewpoint of a reasonable officer in Officer Fox's position. So those events have happened. He sees a scuffle between Officer Robinson and Mr. Harmon. Officer Robinson goes flying. It's at that point that Officer Fox grabs his weapon and begins chasing Mr. Harmon. And then this is the key issue.
And Mr. Harmon is running away. He's not running towards them, is he?
No, he's running away. He, you know, Officer Robinson falls back about 10 feet onto the ground. Mr. Harmon keeps running. And then crucially, he stops sprinting away and starts side shuffling. And at that time, he brings his arms up into his chest. And I don't think plaintiffs dispute this characterization of the video at all. He drops his left arm. He keeps his right arm raised. And again, he's turned back in a position that is a ready and fighting stance.
And nobody sees a weapon. Nobody sees a weapon. You've still got the three police officers and one single guy fairly close to each other.
There's a there's an allegation that the point that the officers did see a weapon and did hear him say something to that effect. But what we're dealing with is a situation where the officers are running and the Mr. Harmon turns around with a knife, with what his hands in a position indicating that he has a knife. And Officer Fox is sprinting after him, and all of a sudden he turns around, and they're very, very close. If you look at page 21 of our brief, you can see Officer Robinson is way off in the distance because he's fallen, but you can see how close their feet are. It is a few feet away. And at that time, when Mr. Harmon turns back in a position indicating that he has a knife, Officer Fox does fire quickly. And these are the exact kind of tense, rapidly evolving, uncertain circumstances that the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have recognized that officers have to make split second life or death decisions. And that's exactly what he had to do.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let me ask, can I ask you a question about that before I forget it? Does the video show Officer Fox's mental state? In other words, you mentioned a few times that Officer Fox thought that he had a knife. So if I watch that video, will that show me that Officer Fox, in fact, genuinely thought that he had a knife?
Certainly not, Your Honor.
And the complaint affirmatively alleges that he didn't think that he had a knife, right?
I don't think that's the case. I think the complaint alleges that he claimed that he saw a knife.
He says that. And then he says all of these things that Officer Fox used to justify the firing were not true, right?
I don't think that they allege in the complaint that his statements were lies. I think that on appeal.
I didn't use the word lies. Any of it. Well, that's my recollection. That's your recollection. I certainly know that he didn't say it's a lie. But in any event, let me ask you this. So if the video doesn't show what Officer Fox's mental state, and hypothetically, if I conclude that a reasonable interpretation of the complaint is that Officer Fox, in fact, did not think that he had a knife. In fact, the judge ultimately concluded that he didn't have a knife. There's nothing in the video about a knife. So how do we, using that universe of facts that he hasn't turned back, that he's raised his arm and lowered one arm in a fighting stance, if he doesn't think that he had a knife, how can we conclude as a matter of law that he had a reasonable belief or probable cause that he was about to use force on Officer Fox if he has, if your rendition now is that he hasn't even come back? He's just going, skipping side to side with one arm raised. Why would Officer Fox or Officer Robinson, for that matter, think that they were in danger if a man is skipping away and he raises his arm and nobody thinks that he has a knife?
Sir, I think there's a lot to unpack right there. So I do think, and as the district court found, I think that the video is clear, and the still frames are really helpful on this, that he was turned back and coming back towards the officers. I grant you that he didn't take a step back towards the officers, but he was not fleeing in the other direction with his head turned back. He had turned back in a way that suggested he was ready to engage with the officers. Now, while the video doesn't show Officer Fox's mental state, that's not the inquiry for the court. The inquiry for the court is, what would a reasonable officer have believed? And so we have to put ourselves in the position of Officer Fox, in which he reasonably believed, even if mistaken, he reasonably believed that Mr. Harmon had thrown Officer Robinson to the ground. He's chasing him and he sees him side shuffle and then turn back with his arm up. And I think something that we haven't talked about yet is there was a knife found on the ground right next to Mr. Harmon's arm.
And that's from the investigative report that is not part of the complaint and it's not part of the video, right?
That's not correct, Your Honor. Officer Robinson's video, as he approaches, clearly shows a knife several inches from Mr. Harmon's right arm as he is approaching. So the knife on the ground next to Mr. Harmon is very much a part of this record. And it's very important because it goes to the issue of reasonable belief. Was it reasonable for
Fox obviously didn't know what was going to be later be found on the ground when the whole incident was through. I mean, Officer Fox didn't see that knife on the ground.
Again, Your Honor, I think that it is the allegations in the complaint are that Officer Fox claimed that he saw a knife. And plaintiffs asked this court to draw the inference that that wasn't true, or that perhaps he was lying in order to justify his shooting. But as the district court recognized, that is an unreasonable inference for this court to draw in light of the fact how Mr. Harmon was acting, and the fact that a knife was on the ground. That is an unreasonable inference to draw. And I think that, very recently, this court's decision in Red v. Oklahoma City from just a few weeks ago, that's a summary judgment case in which the court did credit the testimony of the officers. It scrutinized it closely, but it recognized that it was entirely consistent with the rest of the record and therefore relevant to a determination of what was objectively reasonable. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. Judge Carson, do you have any questions?
Oh, against my judgment, I have one question. So if I look at the video and I walk away from it thinking that everything happened so fast and was, it was dark and that I just can't tell for sure what happened, is that the death knell for your case today?
Not at all, Your Honor. Because in those circumstances, right from the time that he is breaking free of being handcuffed to the time that Officer Fox fires his weapon is about 4 seconds. It's dark. A lot happens. It's chaotic. That is the exact kind of circumstances that we have to consider that officers are placed in. You have to place yourself in Officer Fox's position. And should he have instead waited for the glint of steel, when that decision could have been, as this court has said, suicidal. And so, no, the fact that the video is not perfect and the fact that other inferences could be drawn about what Mr. Harmon was doing does not mean that Officer Fox's reaction and his decision was objectively unreasonable.
I mean, but that's sort of your jury argument right there, isn't it? That's not an argument that it blatantly contradicts what Mr. Lutz has said.
No, Your Honor. I mean, objective reasonableness is a decision for this court to make. And so you have to place yourself in the position of Officer Fox. And if he could have reasonably believed that Mr. Harmon threw Officer Robinson to the ground, even if that turned out to not be true, the video shows that that was a reasonable belief, as was his belief that Mr. Harmon was armed with a knife when he acted like he had a knife and when there was a knife.
Thank you.
Judge Kelly, do you have anything?
Nothing further. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Nichols. We'll hear from Mr. Lutz in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of factual points that I wanted to raise. My colleague referenced, and there was some discussion about the existence of the warrant under which Mr. Harmon was taken under arrest. It is alleged in a complaint that it was a felony warrant. The particular crime is not alleged, and there's no allegation or other indication that Officer Fox knew what the crime was. So for the purpose of the Graham analysis, it is just a felony warrant without further elaboration. There's also no allegation in the complaint about the distance separating the officers. And I would submit that distance is notoriously difficult to ascertain accurately from video evidence without further analysis, which we don't have access to, not being in discovery at this point. I imagine that it could be determined accurately at some point, but that's not something that can be gained from the complaint at this point. Returning to the point that Judge Carson raised, lack of clarity is a death knell at this stage of the litigation. It doesn't mean that that this case will not be determined at a later date when the evidence is capable of testing, but the lack of clarity suggests that the blatant contradiction standard cannot be met, and therefore the district court should be reversed. And I will end with just one point, and it's that the court should not embrace a rule on a motion to dismiss that favors untested evidence over well-pled allegations, except for in the most extreme circumstances, and that is not here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Luce, how do you deal with, I do have a question. Could you address Ms. Nichols' argument that the Scott versus Harris blatantly contradicted standard really doesn't apply because there is a separate line of case law, as she points out, that if a complaint incorporates typically its documentary evidence, in this case, you did refer to video evidence, that you in fact incorporated the three videos into the complaint, and therefore she's not restricted to the Scott versus Harris standard. Could you address that?
Certainly, Your Honor. I'm not sure that it actually is a separate line of cases. All of the authority that I have looked to for the district court's discretionary authority to use video evidence on a motion to dismiss uses some form of the blatant contradiction or the no reasonable jury standard. So I'm not sure that it is. I think Ronquillo was cited for that proposition, which is an unpublished decision from this circuit. I don't think Ronquillo issued the blatant contradiction standard either, and it might be the only authority that we've come across that applies it in the motion to dismiss stage from the circuit.
All right, thank you. Judge Carson, do you have any questions?
Nothing more for me.
All right, thank you. Judge Kelly, do you?
No, thank you.
All right, Mr. Luce and Ms. Nichols, I thought both of your briefs and your arguments today were both just really excellent. And I do appreciate the zealous advocacy of both of you. This matter will be submitted.